I'm Keith MacArthur. Unlocking Bryson's Brain is a podcast about my son.
Hi, Brian.
The rare disease that keeps him from walking or talking.
I mean, Bryson's perfect, but his life is really hard.
And our family's search for a cure.
Oh my gosh, maybe science is ready for this.
It's part memoir, part medical mystery.
We can do just about anything.
Modifying DNA.
My heart and my throat.
Cure is controversial.
Unlocking Bryson's Brain. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Black Heart. COVID is not the only virus on the minds of public health officials. Another one, polio, is making a comeback. So far this year, Malawi, Mozambique, and Israel reported their first cases in 3 decades. In June, UK health officials found poliovirus in wastewater in northeast London. And this summer, health officials in New York diagnosed paralytic polio in a young man, the first polio case in the U.S. in over a decade. It comes at a time when we've seen a significant drop in polio vaccination rates among infants and preschoolers in Canada. I'm old enough to remember just how much polio once terrified Canadians, but most of us haven't seen it and likely wouldn't recognize its early symptoms.
I have a bad cough. Apparently, this is happening with the ones that have had polio and now have COVID. And apparently, it lasts about 6 weeks. I hope not.
Our show this week features a conversation with a woman who's on a mission to jog our memories.
Hi, my name is Mickey Boleen, and I live on the west coast of Canada. I've had polio twice in 2 epidemics, 47 and 53.
Mickey Boleen is 83 years old. Her 2 bouts of polio make her the expert.
Are you fairly aware of polio? Because I know a lot of medical professionals aren't.
Me? I recall those public service announcements from the March of Dimes warning people of all ages to get vaccinated.
Polio is no longer a children's disease. It strikes unprotected adults up to 50 years of age. When polio strikes the breadwinner or the mother, it affects the lives of the whole family, and recovery at best is a long, painful, and costly process. Why take such a risk when protection is as close as your telephone? Pick up the phone now and call your doctor. Make a definite appointment for your polio vaccination.
The last major epidemic of polio in Canada took place in 1953. Close to 9,000 Canadians contracted the disease, and 500 died. At that time, the outbreak was the most severe epidemic in Canada since the 1918 flu pandemic. But today, few, if any, frontline health professionals have even seen a case.
We have a directory for March of Dimes with any medical personnel in Canada that are aware of polio. And I was wondering if I could add your name to it.
Please do. Today, Mickey Boleen lives in Abbotsford, where we reached her. She grew up on a farm in Gladstone, Manitoba, about 160 kilometers outside Winnipeg. As she said, Mickey got polio twice. The first time in 1947, when she was 8.
It was just like the flu. And I probably wouldn't have known if they took me to the doctor and gave me the dreaded spinal tap.
Doctors refer to them as lumbar punctures. A sterile needle is inserted in the space between 2 lumbar vertebrae to take out a small sample of spinal fluid. Back then, doctors performed them to look for evidence of paralytic polio, which occurs in about 1% of cases. Mickey's first brush with polio was relatively mild. How quickly did you recover from the first episode?
About a week. I could never run fast after that, but other than that, no really signs of having had it.
We do not yet have a vaccine. We have been working on a vaccine, and we will continue to work as industriously as possible to develop one as soon as possible, so that it may then be used in as large a number of persons as possible.
In 1948, American researcher Jonas Salk began working on an injectable vaccine. He got a big assist from Canada. Researchers at Connaught Medical Research Laboratories in Toronto developed a technique that enabled Salk to grow poliovirus in a test tube and paved the way for mass production of the vaccine. The Salk vaccine became widely available in Canada in 1955. An oral vaccine invented by another American, Albert Sabin, arrived in 1962. Those vaccines changed everything, but they were too late for Mickey. She contracted polio a second time in 1953 when she was 14.
It was my second week of high school, and I developed the most incredible, painful headache. I went to the principal and asked if I can leave school. And he said, I got a headache too, wish I could leave. Anyways, I went to my aunt's in town because my dad was working there. And she told him to take me to the doctor. The doctor said, if you didn't have polio before, I'd say that's what's wrong. Go home. If you're not better in the morning, go to the hospital.
How did you realize that you couldn't walk?
I went to get out of bed in the morning, and my legs didn't just hold me. I just pulled me up. I just collapsed. I couldn't move on the floor. My parents had to get me up and loaded me in the car and took me to town.
You must have been scared.
I was very scared, very scared. And then, of course, I had to have that horrible spinal tap again. And I was placed in the local hospital in isolation because there were no beds in Winnipeg. I had to wait for one. I don't remember too much of it. I may have been drifting in and out of consciousness. The only thing I could move was my head. And isolation was scary because everything was in white and they were always scrubbing everything down and I couldn't have visitors. Nobody used to explain anything to children at that time. I just kept hearing the word polio and saying, I can't have polio, I had it.
In fact, you can get polio more than once. There are three different subtypes of poliovirus. If you're infected with one, you develop lifelong immunity to it, but not the other two.
When the ambulance came from another town a week later to pick me up, all I saw, remember, is the van was white and it said whites on it. To me, I knew it came from this other town, and to me, that meant it was White's funeral parlor. And I thought, oh, that's weird. They put me in there. Remember, I'm only 14. The ambulance attendants didn't talk to me. They're probably terrified of me, thinking I was contagious anyway. There were no windows in there. And I spent the trip to Winnipeg thinking I was dead, but figured I couldn't do anything about it, and I was pleased I could still think.
That's an understandable assumption on Mickey's part. Back then, funeral directors were directly involved in the ambulance business. Mickey was admitted to a hospital in Winnipeg, the epicenter of that bad polio epidemic of 1953.
I was placed in what would have been a sunroom. The nice part was there was windows on three sides. We're up on the third floor. But because there was such a lack of beds, we're all pushed together. If I could have moved anything but my head, I could have reached over and touched or rolled right onto the next bed. And sometimes during the night, I'd hear noises and I'd wake up. Well, I couldn't move and my voice was just a whisper at that time. But I knew what was going on. Either I would hear a respirator quit during the night, or I'd see the staff come in and move somebody away from the bed next to me. And you knew they'd passed away. This happened about three times in the first week. And we'd ask in the morning where so-and-so went, and they say, oh, we moved her to another room. But I knew that hadn't. I knew what had happened. That was definitely the worst part of the whole situation. It's still it's making me emotional right now.
Mickey says she only got to see her parents twice during a hospital stay that lasted many months.
First, we were in isolation, and somebody had driven my mom to Winnipeg, and the nurses came because we were lucky because we had windows all the way around the room. So the nurses dragged me up to the window. So my head was out of the window on the third floor. And I hollered down to my mom and back and forth. So that was a very brief visit. At Christmas time, if you lived close enough, you could go home for about 3 days. I didn't. I was 100 miles away. And this wonderful little nurse's aide, who'd just gotten married, got permission to take me home. She lived in the top floor of three stories, and her new husband carried me, who had put on about 60 pounds in the hospital, all the way up the stairs, and they had my parents and my little brother come to their house for Christmas dinner, and they even took me to a movie the night before I had to go back to the hospital. She was so wonderful, and I think a very positive influence on my life. But other than that, no, I never saw my family or had any visitors. But I made a lot of friends while I was in the hospital. You know, we hollered back and forth and complained about the treatments, and I was the oldest one in there. The only thing I ever wanted to be was a nurse, and the nurses were nice. When I could move a bit, they put me in a wheelchair and let me attend the nurses' aides meetings and learn to take temperatures and let me deliver the mail. And so part of it was a pleasant experience. It was just that first one, and I can't forget it.
What was it like when you tried to walk as you began to recover from that bout of polio?
A bunch of doctors came in and said it was time for me to walk. It never occurred to me I couldn't. And I got out and proudly walked about 6 feet. And they said, get her back in bed. She's not walking right. I pretty much ignored them. I could tell what time the nurses were coming around all the time. So in the evening, when I figured it was clear, I would get out of bed. And remember, the beds were all right up against each other. I'd hold onto the bed railings and walk down to the other end of the room and back. And I did that all the time until they put me into braces. I don't think they knew I got up in the middle of the night and walked.
When you got up in the middle of the night, were you able to walk right?
No, but it was walking. My right knee goes out backwards.
After 9 months in hospital, Mickey was ready to be discharged. Still, she couldn't walk without help and would eventually need lots of surgery.
By the time I got out of the hospital, my right knee was sideways against my left leg, but my ankle was turned the opposite way and it flopped. So I ended up with a hip brace and crutches. And when they told me to pull up my toes, only my big toe would come up. So they put a pin in my big toe. So now when I want to move my toes, the rest of the toes move, but the big toe doesn't. My ankle is stabilized. I can't lift it up and down or move it sideways. Fortunately, the surgery is still holding. So I walk like flat-footed. Could never wear high heels. That was too bad. My knee straightened out with a brace. But I had my ankle wired. I still have the wires they took out of there and the pin out of my toe. I've just never thrown them away. They're in a little box.
You kept them as a souvenir.
Yeah, well, it was my 16th birthday when I had surgery, so that was my present to me.
Any friends that you've kept to today?
There was a 6-year-old young boy with the most beautiful curly hair that seemed to have adopted me, and he wanted to write to me when he went home. So his mother wrote letters to him. When I sent him my graduation picture, he had a picture taken of him and his dog, a professional picture, and sent it to me. We are still in touch. Unfortunately, I drifted away from a lot of the other friendships.
You said you were interested in being a nurse even before you contracted polio. I think a lot of people in your situation might have been turned off with nursing, you know, after spending 9 months in hospital, but not you. Why do you think that is?
Surprisingly, a lot of us post-polios went into the nursing field, either physiotherapists or lab techs or nurses. I don't know. I never wanted to be anything but. And I had to be interviewed by the doctors from there before I could get permission to go into nurses' training, because I was still wearing a brace and crutches that I threw away 2 weeks before I went in to training. And one doctor believed in me and sent me a beautiful bouquet of yellow roses for my graduation.
Oh, how'd you feel about that?
I still have the card and the pressed roses. Wow. I guess that answers that.
It sure does. How have you managed to keep so positive?
I learned to enjoy life and quit feeling sorry for myself, and that made all the difference. Attitude. And I got to do special things, like in training. I was asked to speak to the student nurses as a patient and as a nurse. So I really researched polio, things like this. I guess it built up my self-esteem. One time we were going swimming in the river, and I wore a long skirt because we didn't wear pants very often then. And I'm trying to get to the edge of the water before I take my skirt off. And one of my classmates said, "What's the matter with you? Everybody's staring at the rest of you, not your legs." Grab my skirt and push me in the water. So after that, I didn't worry about anybody seeing my legs.
What do you think you learned from your hospital stay? How do you think that shaped you both, you know, professionally and personally?
I think it made me a much better nurse. I certainly learned the importance of explaining procedures to my patients. I was a psychiatric nurse, so it wasn't as strenuous on my body as being an RN would, but it was still a three-year course. I think it taught me a lot of compassion. I've done a lot of volunteer work with mentally and physically disabled. Yeah, I think it made me a much more understanding and compassionate person. And I miss my nursing very much.
Mickey made a mostly full recovery from her second bout of polio, but there was more to come. At age 48, she was diagnosed with post-polio syndrome. It's a condition that can affect as many as 4 out of every 10 polio survivors. It begins between 15 and 40 years following their initial recovery. The telltale symptoms are muscle weakness, general fatigue, and joint pain.
Mine was triggered by a bout of cancer. A lot of polio people I have talked to, triggered by something traumatic, might have been a car accident, a death in the family, a serious illness. I just didn't get better from the cancer. Physically, I did. Mentally, I didn't, and I was really weak. I mean, I could get exhausted brushing my teeth in the morning. And I knew something was wrong. And then I read a newspaper article that had been written by somebody that formerly lived in the town I'm in now. And I contacted her. And I remembered a doctor had told me, probably when I was having surgery when I was 16, to be aware that one day I may wake up and not be able to walk again. And that really worried me till I got to be about 30, and then I just forgot about it, got on with life and forgot about that mention. But I had been warned before.
What were your symptoms? You said exhaustion. Were there any other symptoms?
Mainly exhaustion. I tried going back to work and I couldn't. By the time I got on the ward, I was just too tired and I'd have to go home again. So I was off work for about 6 months afterwards. And then I went on graveyard shift, so I wouldn't have as much walking. And then eventually I was walking with a cane. When I was 52, by this time I was on crutches and they didn't want me. I worked in federal corrections and they didn't want me on the wards with crutches.
How do you get around these days?
I'm on crutches 90% of the time. And now I can't walk more than 3 feet is pushing it if I walk that far without crutches. So I keep them pretty close by. I have a wheelchair and a scooter if I'm going to be someplace that involves a lot of walking. It's and COVID, I guess, because I sat around so much, I seem to have gotten much weaker. I'm usually a very active person. And now I'm finding I, even with crutches, I walk far less and do far less than I did 3 years ago.
Polio did not derail Mickey's nursing career, but post-polio did. We'll be right back.
I've reported other people's stories for a long time, confronting people in power. But behind this broadcast voice, I've hidden my greatest secret. I was in an abusive marriage. It lasted a year, but it changed my life. Part of me always blamed myself for what happened, and I've lived with the shame. So many of us live like this. It's time we change that. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Welcome to Paradise is My Story. Available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
You're listening to White Coat Black Art. This week, the reemergence of polio, a disease once close to global eradication, is now just a plane ride away. And that threat comes as polio vaccination rates in Canada have slipped. That is especially true for infants and preschoolers born since the pandemic.
I think what we've seen across the country has been a general decline in the uptake of routine immunizations. Polio is given in infancy, and we've certainly seen a decline there.
That's Dr. Jia Hu. He's a family doctor in Calgary and former medical officer of health in Alberta. He's the CEO of 19 to Zero, a not-for-profit coalition of health and other experts that aims to help get Canadians vaccinated. I began our conversation by asking how worried he is about the drop in vaccination rates.
I think they're pretty concerning. You know, I remember that in 2019, vaccine hesitancy was declared, you know, one of the 10 greatest threats to public health. And from some of the surveys that 19 to Zero had done last fall, on average, we're seeing like a 20% to 25% decline across all childhood immunizations. On average, you can think of routine childhood immunizations as, you know, around 80% coverage across the country. And so when we did our surveys about a year ago, about 1 in 4 parents said they thought that their kids might have missed or delayed a routine immunization. We actually know that we've seen the biggest drops in school-based immunizations, right? School-based vaccinations are closed, therefore rates plummeted. When it came to some of the infant stuff that the polios you're talking about, you know, if people weren't able to see their family doctor in places like Ontario, if they weren't able to get a public health appointment in places like Alberta, you'd see declines. So there's a lot of variation there. But I mean, if we see big drops like that, at some point, especially as society begins to reopen, which it kind of has, you will see a return of these illnesses that we've, you know, largely eradicated. And there's totally a crisis in primary care. I mean, I'm also a family doctor. And, you know, I think what we need is primary care to be supported in providing immunizations.
Dr. Hu says there are ways to boost vaccine rates in Canada, better access to family doctors and nurse practitioners, and online registries that tell patients and parents of young children if they need to top up their immunizations. He says we need to boost vaccine rates now. What is at stake if we don't catch up infants and children here in Canada on their immunization rates? What are you most afraid of?
I'm most afraid of a resurgence of a lot of the diseases that we have largely eradicated or have controlled in the country, right? And so polio is being detected in wastewater in a number of jurisdictions around the world. And polio is something we don't really see anymore in Canada. And I think that, you know, a lot of these diseases we actually can achieve herd immunity for, which is something maybe we can't do for COVID. But I don't want to see a resurgence of things like polio. I don't want to see, you know, measles outbreaks happening. If I go to some of those, you know, school-based vaccines, something like Gardasil, you know, which is used for the human papillomavirus, you know, every year, HPV, human papillomavirus-related cancer, still kill Canadians. And the best way we can actually prevent those from happening is by ensuring that people are vaccinated. And so I think it's imperative to actually get our vaccine rates back up to snuff, back up to where they were before the pandemic. I think it's good that, from a lot of our surveys, what we haven't seen is too much mistrust in other vaccines because of COVID, right? There's a lot of misinformation, mistrust on COVID, but people still generally trust these other vaccines, which is wonderful. And to really restore coverage, I mean, I think we just need to ensure that, you know, access is restored. Parents actually know that they've missed vaccines, and they make it a bit of a priority to book with their family doctor or book with public health or go to their school-based vaccinations to ensure their kids are caught up and protected.
One person who has watched polio's comeback with a growing sense of alarm is Mickey Boleen. She's on a campaign to increase vaccination rates, one parent at a time.
I have a lot of talks with my doctor whenever I do go to see him about we're just waiting for it to show up because there's just not enough immunization going on, even in the area I live in. Last time I I've been checking on off and on with the local health offices for years, and we were running at about 40% not immunized. So
as a polio survivor, as a post-polio syndrome survivor, how do you feel about that?
I feel terrible about it. I have been trying to promote immunization all my life. I've used it as a subject for a contest in Toastmasters, so that I got to spread it to others. I speak to Rotary groups, etc. And I will walk up to somebody with a new baby, and especially in the doctor's office, and say, "Oh, what a cute baby. How old is it, etc.? I hope you have that baby immunized." And when they say no, and I said, "Oh, please don't let them grow up to be like me. Polio's only a plane ride away." They look like they can't wait to get away from me fast enough.
How do you feel hearing that reaction, you know, seeing that a parent might want to run away with their infant after you tell them, "Don't let what happened to me happen to your child"?
They just don't understand. I mean, I talk to friends of mine that are against immunization, and they've seen what all I've gone through. I've talked to next door neighbors. Used to go over to one and practice my speech for the Toastmasters. She eventually did get immunized through a naturopath, but it took a few years to get her there. It really upsets me that people are not having their immunization. They just don't understand what could happen. And not just for polio, I mean many other diseases as well. And I do get really upset when they try and go into really depth to explain why they're not getting immunized. That does get to me. All about, "I don't understand what's in these and how dangerous they are." And I said, "Trust me, if I could have had immunization, I wouldn't have had polio twice and I'd still be dancing." So that's the thing I miss the most.
I hope Mickey's story and her pitch to get vaccinated has as big an impact on parents as it did on me. That's our show this week. If you'd like to comment, our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. Whitecoat Black Art was produced this week by Amina Zoffer, with help from senior producer Colleen Ross, Jeff Goods, Sujata Berry, and Stephanie Dubois. Our digital producer is Ruby Buiza. Technical support was by Lauda Antonelli. That's medicine on my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.